This is always the most difficult session, just after lunch. But we've had such a rich diet of compellingly interesting presentations yesterday and today that I think that there is no difficulty in keeping awake even after the very good lunch that we've just enjoyed. Chris Shaw in the previous session referred to the imagery that has emerged during the course of our conference, and I'd also begun to develop a feel for this, and I was quite nostalgic when I saw the title of the conference, Old Wine and New Bottles, or New Bottles and Old Wine, whichever the combination is, because it took me back to the very beginnings of my academic career, which seems to have been marked by metaphor. In the 1970s and early 80s, I think wine and bottles was probably one of the most favoured metaphors in journal articles. I can recall probably half a dozen combinations of wine, bottles, and quite disparate issues that were funneled into both of them. but they were replaced by animal images, I think in the 80s or early 90s. And one of the favorites of the 90s, late 80s and early 90s, as I recall, was based on the fable of the blind men and the elephant. And I don't know whether you recall that. It appears in many cultures around the world, but discussions of the EEAS reminded me very much of this, because the articles that incorporated that into their title related to attempts by various people who were challenged in terms of their capacity to see in describing phenomena, so that a group of blind men sought to describe the elephant and, of course, touched different parts of the animal and consequently described quite different things. And I thought that was highly appropriate for the External Action Service as it's been presented to us over the last day and a half. And and of course, not wishing to press this any much further, just to say that that was replaced by dogs that did not bark, based on the Sherlock Holmes story, and even more recently, of course, elephants in the room, which takes us back to the elephants. Anyway, that was all by way of almost irrelevant introduction. David said at the beginning of the day that we move from the more conceptual to the more to practice. But actually, I think the balance is still in play here, because this morning's session, I think, to quite considerable extent, presented us with issues that are critical to understanding what's happening both in the European context, but more broadly in the world of diplomacy, and that's something that I think that we will pick up on in the sessions this afternoon. We're very privileged to have with us two practitioners, Bruno Hansus from the delegation in Kinshasa, and Daniel Scheer in the delegation in Kigali, where they're both political counselors. So without further ado, I'm going to ask Bruno, first of all, to present his paper, and then immediately Daniel. Thank you very much. Thanks very much, Bruno. So there is a reward for keeping calm and carrying on.
Absolutely.
fascinating insights. Let's move straight over to Daniel.
Thank you very much, and of course, thank you very much for the organizers for inviting me here, and it's good to see everybody. So far, it's been a very interesting conference. If we stick on the animals topic, I think I must be the strangest animal here because I'm an Estonian diplomat who is working in the EAS and working in Africa, which is well known to be one of the big priority areas for Estonia. We have absolutely zero embassies in sub-Saharan Africa. So my interest is, of course, is that I will be used in my service as an Africa expert in the future. So I'm also testing our system. Not only are we testing the EAS. I'm going to give you a little bit shorter structure and role of our delegation. I think Bruno did a good job of covering that in general. I'll be touching on the changes after Lisbon. And then I'm going to give you an example from the current Congo crisis of where we have a certain case of where do we want to take it? What would be the role of the EAS? What do the member states want us to do? And maybe we can discuss that afterwards. I'll touch briefly on small and new member states, what's their interest in the EAS, and we'll go on from there. So the structure of our delegation is quite heavy on the Commission side. Of the 40 people we have, some are 14, 15 are expats. Of those expats, there are four are from the EAS. The head of delegation, myself, the head of the administration, and the secretary to the ambassador, to the head of delegation. Excuse me. That was from the last presentation on legal aspects. So basically, there's two of us who are responsible for all political questions in the entire delegation. We have a delegation that has a budget of 300 million euros over 6 years from the EDF, the European Development Fund, that we do about 80% of it is budget support. So this is where the political analysis, in my opinion, is very important. And I think this is where it links to what we heard yesterday from Robert Cooper regarding the political aspects of development. On the interesting side, we have nine member states represented, which is quite interesting. Of course, some of the usual suspects have a little bit more representation in our delegation than others. But I mean, we do have also a Finn as well in our delegation. So I mean, we are trying to really work on this geographical balance. Changes after Lisbon. I think one thing that we haven't talked about in great detail, but the change of the name. I think a name is very important. The delegations used to be called the European Commission delegation. Now it's called the European Union delegation. And I think we don't give enough value to that, because European Commission, at least from my experience in our country, was still quite an abstract idea. They didn't connect to the fact that the 300 million euros that we're giving as aid comes from not only the European Commission but also from all of the 28 member states. So I think it's very important that we take this opportunity now and very much promote that all of the activities that are taking place in abroad are EU activities. They're no longer European Commission or ECHO or CSDP. They're EU, and they're owned by the member states. So the member states who are contributing to it. So the political section, of course, didn't exist in our embassy before, or in our delegation before we came. Another slip of the tongue. Before we arrived, we do have the presidency role, the coordination. I think another point that wasn't mentioned was the drafting of documents. If there's a HOMS report, we're the first ones that do the draft after the first discussion of the meeting. And then all the changes that are put into it are done by us. Démarches, we're the lead on EU common positions. It's the EU delegation who leads the démarche. We co-chair such thing as the Article 8 meetings, which is under the Cotonou Agreement, where it's a EU country dialogue on governance questions, which Bruno also brought up, where the EU gets the first word as being the representative of the European Union. Another important factor that I think that's come into now is that in our delegation, we have our commission workers are all from DEVCO, but other delegations have, for example, trade and environment, and these people have been very much concentrating on their specific topic. They've been specialists, but now that the name has changed, that you're representing the European Union, these commission workers need to also think as diplomats. They have to realize that they're also representing the entire EU. So I don't think there's a problem with commission people inside the ES, those who have been in RELICS. I think we already have the same experience. We've already been in delegations. We've been dealing with the topics. But I think the detach is maybe with the other commission DGs who are not sure how their DG fits into the foreign policy aspects and how their role fits into the delegation. So I think very much so having training together with these people, and of course we need more of these people. For example, we do for climate change, that was EAS political counselor who received, I don't know, 20, 30 page briefing that I had to read before going to do a démarche in 2 days, in addition to all of my other topics. I think there's one trade person for all of East Africa, the East African community. So I think that the commission side could help reinforce what we're doing. There's been a lot of discussions today as to the objectives and the priorities. I looked up the treaty, and I think it says very clearly there's 2 points. One that says that the European Council shall identify the strategic interests and objectives of the Union, and the second that the Council shall frame the common foreign policy, common foreign and security policy, and take the decisions necessary for defining and implementing it. So I think it's very clearly already put into the treaty that the leadership comes from the Council, and the EAS is there to implement the common policy. But now, not all topics are common. Foreign policy. So I think in this point, I think this is where we go to this multilateralism versus bilateralism, with the EU being a multilateral organization, but the EAS also having to act as a bilateral actor, because not all topics or all policy is common. So the EAS also has to have the information. They have to be able to analyze. They have to have the local contacts in the third countries to be able to discuss, to be able to form a common position. So I think that's where both multilateralism and bilateralism applies to the EAS. Now I'm going to go over a little of the situation in Rwanda, and hopefully you don't mind that I'd like to do this in under Chatham House rules. During the beginning of the conflict, we have very regular contacts with the government, member state homes meetings. There's 6 member states in Kigali, so it was very simple to cooperate. The situation that came was this dilemma in Rwanda of development versus good governance and human rights, where we have a country who uses development funds very well and is having some challenges in the governance side. So we had some member states quickly made decisions or took actions regarding their development cooperation. For example, Sweden, Germany, and the Netherlands decided based on certain reports that they were going to freeze their aid. Then there was a decision made by the UK a little bit later to freeze the aid, and then After several steps had taken, then it was somehow decided that maybe we needed a common position. So the question here is, when And how? Is it a member state that comes and says, now we need to have a common position? Or is it expected of the EAS to say, now we need a common position so that we don't have these first steps taken? For example, the EU had a similar analysis as the UK, that those commitments that we had made, we have to keep our commitments, and we decided to go that route. But the pressure that was put on to us to freeze by the previous decisions was quite strong. And linked to this, what about those member states who are not represented in Kigali? Do they make decisions based on our reporting, or do they make decisions based on Human Rights Watch reports? And there was pressure in the PSC, in the COPs, from member states who are not present, who had heard from other sources what they thought was happening in the country. So we really have to put into place how is the path of when do we need to have a common policy. Another difficulty was on the intelligence side. The EU obviously doesn't have any defense attachés in the delegations. There is some discussion regarding this taking place. Some member states have intelligence, but don't give any access to the delegation. On a bilateral level, yes, we do get the information, but can we take oral information as a basis for making decisions regarding major amounts of funds, and that can make a risk to our relations with the same country. Another point was that it was interesting that in some cases we were very close contact with Kinshasa, but in some cases we had different analysis. It is also where Kinshasa is 2,000 kilometers from Goma and Kigali is 90, but we also very much influenced by our proper governments in the countries that we are. So some member states have antennas in the Kivu, so obviously they were very well informed of the situation. I have one example of a good, I think a very positive example of the EAS, where in Afghanistan, the naming of the USR / head of delegation gave an opportunity to coordinate all of the member states. Up until then, it was the position of UNAMA to do the coordination, but they weren't very much interested in the UN mission in Afghanistan, weren't interested in the small member states, and that limited our access to information. But with the arrival of the ESR head of delegation, he was able to, or his job was to share the information from the high-level meetings that he participated in. I don't have time, one minute for small member states. I think
we won't tell them.
I think that this is the EAS is very important for small member states and new member states. They don't have a very large framework of embassies around the world, so this gives them a chance to get to widen that coverage, give access to their non-resident ambassadors, who are able to often get support from the delegation, either in organizing meetings or even having a desk with a computer or sharing other information. Also getting access to main players, even in those countries where they're represented. I think that that these countries are also honest brokers in various countries. So having new members or not only that, but also having countries that don't have a strategic interest working in the EAS is useful, because that maintains the EU's honest broker role that was, I think, mentioned earlier before. And then there was, of course, a talk previously about replacing embassies, having support structures for sending just one diplomat to, for example, to an EU delegation. And then the consular services question, which when we have very small frameworks or networks, then it's difficult to work on.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.